This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Arizona immigration law case.
Don't kid yourself. While this was a split decision, if you're an undocumented immigrant, the glass is half empty.
We'll take a look at the chilling technology of microchips. Technically, they're RFID technology, and they're intruding in our daily lives.
These spy chips have been used on clothes, articles you buy. Now they're used on dogs. Soon they will be used on non-human mammals. Are humans next?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week the Supreme Court handed down a split decision on Arizona's immigration law. Can you give us a nutshell summary of what this means?
I will today, Heidi. And of course, today, if people continue to listen to the show, we're going to have Kathy Albisa on the show to talk about some of the effects of that decision on undocumented people, as well as other people who are possibly racially profiled. But before we get to Kathy, the court did come down with a decision in United States versus Arizona, or Arizona v. U.S., as it finally went up to the court. And they struck down three very bad provisions of the immigration law. They struck it down on what's called federal preemption grounds, which really means federal trumping grounds. Because the federal government has actually legislated in this area, they said three of the laws passed by Arizona were unconstitutional. Those were one that made it a failure to register with the federal government. That was going to be a crime under Arizona law. Two, a crime to work or apply for work if you're an undocumented worker. And the third one, arresting non-citizens or arresting undocumented people without warrants if they're committing a crime that makes you deportable. So they struck down those three, not on substance, but on the fact that, well, the federal government has legislated in this area and therefore not going to allow Arizona to do that. The fourth one, which many people would call the core of the Arizona law, and which certainly people of color would call the core and undocumented people would call the core, as I think Michael Smith may have a good description for, what is the core of what the Supreme Court failed to do?
Show me your papers. When Europeans lived in fear of the Nazis, you know, and immigrants in France, and a cop would come up to them, show me your papers. It's a show me your papers law.
Right. And so what that is, it allows cops who stop people for driving in some way, having an blinkered headlight, some excuse by the cop, it allows the cop to inquire about the immigration status of anyone stopped or arrested. Let me say that again. It allows police to inquire about the immigration status of anyone stopped or arrested if they have reason to suspect the person might be in any way here illegally.
Now,
reason
Michael,
to suspect.
Reason to suspect. Objective or subjective standard?
Good question, Heidi. There's two standards that are not necessarily in the law, but that are in a video. I want you to listen to this. A video produced by Arizona to train cops. Think about that. Because this law is obviously completely vague, what does it mean, reason to suspect might be in the country illegally? We know that from our experience with stop and frisk laws, that reason to suspect is completely misused. But let's talk about the video and the answer to your question, Heidi. The first is there's some objective stuff. But of course, it doesn't get into why the person is stopped initially, but there's some objective stuff. Once the person is stopped, if they don't have a driver's license, if they can't give a permanent residence, then they can inquire about the person's immigration status and arrest them, essentially, and get them into a deportation proceeding. So those are objective. They're awful. I mean, because they're barely objective, because a person may not have his license because he left it at home. I mean, who knows?
Well, why stop them in the first place?
Right. Well, that goes back to the earlier question, but this is once they're stopped. So once they're stopped, they may have their license at home. They may be traveling through the state on a visit. It also allows, if they have a foreign-registered car, all kinds of reasons allowing the cops to then say, quote, objectively determine their immigration status. But then it goes, the video that's produced by Arizona goes through a bunch of subjective factors. You stop someone in a car driving. Objective factors are out, let's say. And if the person has, quote, as the video says, produced by Arizona, unexplained nervousness. I mean, that's just absurd. To say that the person driving has unexplained nervousness and therefore you can inquire about his or her immigration status is like saying, why don't we just arrest every Hispanic person in Arizona? Because whatever the reasons are, I can tell you, you stop by a cop in Arizona and you're a Hispanic, the chances are very high that you're going to be nervous, whatever that means to be nervous. Or the person fails to make eye contact. Can you imagine that? You fail to make eye contact with the cop and you're considered someone who might be in the country illegally, according to the cop. Or the person is dressed. It doesn't say how dressed. How are they dressed? Their person's dress can indicate that they're an undocumented worker or immigrant. Or they have significant difficulty communicating in English. Now, lots of people in Arizona and New Mexico, I assume, have problems in that area because they're Mexican. A large number come out of Mexican origin families. So those are reasons you can then inquire into the immigration status. So it's a completely subjective standard. And what the Supreme Court did by saying that this part of the law was not unconstitutional on its face, it opened the floodgates to these kind of stops and inquiring about immigration status, not only for people in Arizona, but we've gotten notes and letters from people who are subject to stop and frisk or to people who are African American in the southern states, etc. Now, the argument that's given the other way is the Supreme Court said, well, we hope this isn't going to be enforced in a discriminatory way. If it is, well, you come back to this court and we will look at the law again. But it's testing the law on tens of thousands of people who will be deported. And that what's amazing, this decision was 8-0. There's 9 people on the court. Kagan recused herself because she had been on the cases earlier when she was Solicitor General. 8-0 on this issue, which is the core of the immigration law in Arizona. And I just want to say a word about the controversy and then ask you a question, Mike. There was some debate within the legal circles about this. Some people say this is a big win for pro-immigration forces and a defeat for Arizona. David Cole, a board member of CCR, was one of the people who wrote an article in Nation about that, calling it anti-immigration forces lose big in Supreme Court. We just don't agree. I don't agree. The Center for Constitutional Rights doesn't agree, and people can see the CCR's press release on their website at ccrjustice.org. So you can't look at it, I don't think, as a big win when really the people on the ground who are going to suffer from this are saying this is a total loss. My son's partner was in Arizona at Arizona Puente when this decision came down, and I can tell you there were tears and crying and screaming, really, about how sad this would be for non-citizens in the United States.
It's an open hunting license to harass Hispanics. Jan Brewer, the right-wing governor of Arizona, is gleeful about it. Joe Arapaio, the racist sheriff who puts immigrants in tents that are 120 degrees, he's gleeful about it. This is a big loss.
I mean, yeah, they struck down laws on preemption on the grounds that the federal government legislated. But in the end, they left a core part of this law in place for that could go after undocumented Hispanics, particularly in Arizona, but will spread to other states and will be used against other populations.
It's already in the hopper in a number of states. This gave the green light to harass these people.
So stay tuned, because we're going to bring on Kathy Albisa to talk about some of the human rights implications of this decision, Arizona v. United States. Last week, the Supreme Court delivered a split decision on Arizona's 2010 immigration law. It was a split decision, but it upheld the most controversial section of that law, the Show Me Your Papers provision. The provision requires police officers to check the immigration status of all people stopped, detained, or arrested if there is, quote, reasonable suspicion to believe that the person is an undocumented immigrant. Reasonable suspicion can include objective factors, but it also includes subjective factors. The person is nervous, doesn't look the officer in the eyes. So despite many people claiming that the Supreme Court decision was a victory for immigration advocates, it was not at all, particularly when you talk to people on the ground. And today we are going to talk to Kathy Albisa, a constitutional and human rights lawyer. She is also the co-founder of the National Economic and Social Rights Forum, and she works with people who are most affected by this new Supreme Court decision.
Kathy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You know, that Arizona decision is really chilling for those of us who are first or second generation or identify at all with immigrants, especially because that fear haunting all the time about some cop coming over and saying, show me your papers, is something that I always grew up with. And to see it broadcast across the TV spectrum and on the front page of the New York Times, what was your reaction to the Supreme Court decision?
My reaction, in fact, the reaction of a lot of people we work with, was that we're not even having the right conversation. There was an involved technical decision regarding the relationship between the federal government and the state government. And the one thing that was lost, except for a few glimpses, a couple of lines, is the people at the heart of this problem. The people who have been displaced from their home countries through basically the global economy, then stripped of legal personhood when they come here, and as you said, now living in a chronic and constant state of fear.
Let me get you back for 1 second. I want to go there because you guys, or Nesra, your organization, wrote a very good statement around the decision. But you are saying what's being left out are the people. But I know there's some other people out there, more lawyers than others, saying this was a big victory for immigration advocates. And I'd like to just place us in that for a second and then go to your statement, really.
All right. Well, to step back, I think it's a reflection of what a degraded state of politics and rights we're in, that if you pass a law that shocks the conscience, the fact that you got rid of some of it or most of it becomes a victory. That only reflects that we actually were worried that we would allow that portions of that law to stand. That is an enormous shift from where we were just a few decades ago. So I think that the claims of victory are in themselves very, very troubling signs because our expectations have become so low that we consider it a step forward when you don't have arrests based on the simple fact that you walked across a border because you needed a job. Even those who are not claiming a victory and have a critical analysis of the show your papers, I think even the New York Times described it as the centerpiece of the law, because at the heart of the law is an intent to treat this group of people differently from other groups of people in the state of Arizona, to single them out, to say that there's something about them where you could ask them for their papers and then pursue some sort of punitive steps afterwards. Even for those who have a critique, they're still really focused on the preemption doctrine, which was the focus of the case. There isn't an end the parallel.
By the preemption doctrine, you mean the doctrine by which the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional three sections of the law because the federal government had legislated in that area. Those are the three sections that we talked about a little earlier in this show. Keep going. I just want
to explain. So the focus was, again, a lot of the focus was on the relationship between the federal government and the state government. And then there's some discussion of equal protection in terms of, you know, racial profiling and show your papers. And, you know, in our view, for example, is only a step or two away from stop and frisk and what we see here in New York.
Yeah, it's very similar, it seems to me. I mean, because it's reasonable suspicion, and then you can get the person's immigration status. I mean, it seems very, very related in a way.
Right, and what's reasonable tends to shift.
You know, we talked about that here because apparently there's a video in Arizona that goes through what's reasonable, and apart from, quote, objective things like not having a driver's license, there's also in the Arizona video to train their police things like, if the person acts nervous, they don't look you directly in the eye, that's reasonable suspicion.
But where I think we have fallen short in the political discourse is what does that kind of racism, what does that kind of living under constant threat do to a community, to a person, and to a set of human rights that we all should be defending and promoting in a very intense way right now, given the threats to human rights.
You know, that kills me. There was a letter in the Times last week that was from an undocumented worker, and it really said the heart of what you're saying in graphic form. It said, every time I drop my child off at school, I never know whether I will be picking her up.
That is the conversation that's missing, except in some small spaces. And that conversation is never tied to the rights people should have, right? It's a conversation at best based on heartbreaking victimhood stories, but we haven't tied it to a broader political framework of the kind of rights we should have in this country.
Yeah, I'd like to get into that, Kathy. It seems to me that what the powers that be here are doing is a real divide and conquer strategy, that they're saying to the poor people in Arizona, a lot of whom support this wretched law, they're taking your jobs, which isn't even true. And the powers that be that have caused this economic crisis to begin with are never singled out. And instead, you've got people who are victimized already being doubly victimized. I wanted you to talk about that, if you could.
You know, immigration has always been a divide and conquer from the xenophobic side of the aisle. I mean, there are arguments that they're taking your jobs overseas. There are arguments that they're taking your jobs here. So it really doesn't, it almost doesn't matter where people from the global south seem to be, they're always accused of taking someone's jobs. No one's ever accused of, you know, outsourcing these jobs. No one's ever accused of racing to the bottom to create exploitative labor conditions, except, again, in the circles in which we run. But in terms of the bigger discourse and the divide and conquer, the argument moves from place to place, but it's the same argument. It's dividing basically often the white working class or African Americans from the rest of the other people of color around the globe.
You guys wrote a very important statement that's been published widely at Nesri on what you consider human rights ought to be for all populations.
What we've put out was a reflection on what would we be talking about and what would we be deciding if we had a human rights vision in our legal framework. Now, I want to clarify, we didn't say if we had incorporated human rights law, because human rights law, while much better than the law of the United States, still has to evolve in some of these areas, especially on the transnational pieces. But if you have a human rights vision, where you just start with the basic premise that all people deserve their full range of rights, then you have to ask yourself a different set of questions. You know, what do these laws in Arizona do to people's right to family, as you pointed out, right to employment? Because you have a right to a job by virtue of the fact that you're a human being. It doesn't matter what your status is. And in fact, the Inter-American Court had decided in 2003 that the U.S. was in violation of regional norms because so long as someone is working here, whether they're deportable or not, they should have access to all the same rights as a worker that other people do. And that was after the Hoffman decision. You have a right to housing. You have a right to education. You have a right to what they call enabling rights, like transportation, because how can you work and how can you exercise your other rights if you can't go from place to place? And if we assessed it in that context, and if we assessed it from a global perspective, understanding that we live in a global economy, that rights cross borders, if people can cross border and capital can cross border, protection should cross borders as well, then we have to ask at least three different questions. One is, why do we have several million people living here in this country, basically, as you said, Mike, in the shadows?
Perhaps 11 million.
It's probably a conservative number.
Right, I would agree. It's maybe 15
I often
million.
Don't cite the number because it's really too hard to...
Right. But we're just reacting to several.
Yeah, but it's millions of people.
Right.
It could be 11, could be 20, we're not sure.
Right.
The point is we don't treat people in that position as people, so we can't even count them. Why are they here? If you look at the reason that they cross borders, it's economic. 10, 11 million people don't wake up in their home country one day saying, you know, life's just not interesting enough here. I want to try something different. I live in a desert. I want to see the forest. That's not what's happening.
Right.
This isn't tourism. These are people who are displaced. They're displaced for economic reasons. We have a whole body of law on refugees that says we can't send people back when there are political conditions or rights conditions in our narrow framework of rights that would harm them. But we don't look at the grinding poverty that displaces people as a rights question. And when you do look at poverty as a rights question, what you see is a group of people whose rights have been violated in the country, in their own country, based on both national and international global economic policies. They leave, they flee like refugees, they're economic refugees, to try to find a way to exercise their right to employment, their right to a decent job, their right to subsistence, their right to housing. And when they arrive in a country trying to exercise their human rights, they find they don't have any there either. And in fact, the very reason for their victimization, their displacement, becomes the very reason that we deny them their rights here. So if you don't look at it globally, if you don't start arguing that rights need to be portable, if capital can be portable, rights need to be portable, and if you don't consider that economic and social rights have to be part of the panorama, you erase that reality from our political discourse.
Now, one thing you say in the statement in speaking about this, you talk about U.S. policies, trade, investment, and foreign affairs support the interests of U.S. agribusiness and are important factors in the creation of the underlying economic and political conditions that lead to the immigrants coming to the United States. So just to address that as well.
Sure. Let me address that one with a story, because what we forget again is that this involves people, families, and everyone's personal story. And I think you know my friend Lucas Benitez, who is a lead organizer at the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And Lucas came to the United States when he was 16. He didn't come to the United States because he wanted to backpack across the country either. He came to the United States because his father lost his farm. His father lost his farm right after NAFTA.
NAFTA being?
NAFTA being the North American Free Trade Agreement. What happened was they raised corn.
Lucas Benitez's
family raised corn, among other things. The new set of subsidized products coming into Mexico from American agribusiness undermined family farms that had been functioning for generations, supporting families for generations.
Right. What NAFTA did, because I remember it then, it allowed, as you said, subsidized corn to come into Mexico, mm-hmm. and that just wiped out hundreds of thousands of Mexican farmers.
And that law was promoted as a law that was going to create jobs. It was promoted by a Democratic president to create jobs.
Exactly. And Lucas, who was 16, didn't know anything about this. All he knew was that suddenly they couldn't sell the food that they had been growing for generations.
Makes me cry, the story.
And they weren't a rich family, but they were self-sufficient.
Wow.
They were close.
I met Lucas, obviously, when I went to visit Jake at Immokalee. So.
And they continue, despite the strain of displacement, to be a tight-knit family. But Lucas had to be the first to go across the border and go pick produce, tomatoes, cucumbers, whatever he could find, in Immokalee, Florida. Lucas then finds himself in Immokalee, Florida, and because he's a farm worker, he has no protection against a whole range of abuses. He doesn't work directly for his employer. He's subcontracted. He's brought in by a subcontractor. He's facing wage theft, violence, insults, irregular work, no overtime. You know the conditions of farm workers, and it's something that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has done a lot to change. His family was stripped of their autonomy in their country. There, then he's separated from them, so he can squeeze whatever money he can out of a $10,000-$12,000 a year job to send back home. And he has to tolerate a range of abuses in order to do this exploitive work, which in fact his family did as farmers back home. That's the story of displacement, and you multiply that by millions of people who either never had access to decent work in their country because of trade, aid, and other development policies, or currency policies. You can look at a range of things, a range of macroeconomic decisions that affect people on a very micro level and cause them to make decisions they would never want to make.
I think that's really important because obviously the prevailing dialogue in this country, or the prevailing story, is that it's the migrants' fault, that they came here illegally, quote, illegally, and that all the responsibilities on them. And what you're really saying to us is we have to look at the global picture and the global context, particularly the United States, on a number of these economic policies.
Actually, there are two stories, and they're both problematic and they're both divisive. There is the dangerous migrant, or the migrant that, you know, is willing to do a job for any price, and they're going to come and take our jobs, and it's their fault, and they need to be staying home. And then there's the good immigrant story. They're just here to work hard and support their families. So it's okay that we pay them so little, because at the end of the day, they're willing to do it, and we're doing them a favor.
It's more than they would work in Mexico.
It's more
than they'd make in Mexico.
And it's more than they make in Mexico. One appears more benign on the surface than the other. Both are deeply problematic. None of our narratives really talk about people crossing borders as the same as people who live here. They're either somehow willing to work harder and therefore we should just let them work for those pennies, or they're nefarious in some way. But the reality is they're no different from scores of families here trying to, you know, eke out a living in an increasingly sadistic economy and structurally inequitable economy.
Kathy, now I know Nesri has been active on this front. It supports a lot of organizations that deal with immigrants. But give us a sense of how do the groups on the ground see this decision, and how is Nesri or those groups going to struggle against really the show me your papers aspect of this, which will now spread, I fear, to many other places?
Groups will all find it outrageous. Groups that work with communities and know what it means to have to live like that will all find it outrageous. I think there'll be a range of responses because state by state, city by city, the context is slightly different. But all communities on the ground are feeling an increasing need to either organize or flee. You know, some people are just leaving. You hear about towns that are just abandoned.
This
in
Arizona.
In Alabama, no.
Oh, in Alabama,
I'm
right.
I'm thinking more as a national phenomenon, because Alabama is not unique, unfortunately. As a national phenomenon, as it's these sort of xenophobic measures are spreading across the country, you're seeing two different responses. Some people are organizing. They feel like it's a matter of survival at this point to organize, because alone they're completely vulnerable. And some organizers are saying, you know, we can't even organize just as immigrants. If we don't work within some sort of broader movement-building framework, we're never going to be able to protect ourselves. And then other people are, like I said, they're fleeing because they lost hope. These are the two paths you see communities take. The ones that want to hold on to hope are organizing and demanding their rights. And solidarity, I think, at this point is crucial, because those organizers out there who are saying, we need a broader human rights movement, it can't be just about us, because we're going to drown if we're out here on our own with so few rights and so few resources trying to move this forward. I think they're right. I think we really need to think about how to unify with movements that are made up of undocumented people.
How do people get in touch with Nesri if they want to plug into this, Kathy?
And where do they get your statement?
The statement is on our blog on our homepage at www.nesri.org. And they could get in touch with us at our general email at info@nesri.org. We're happy, depending on where people are, to put them in touch with partners and allies who are working in response to this decision, but also to the ongoing degrading conditions in the country for all poor communities, because what these communities have in common with other communities that are under siege is that they're very poor. And if we don't figure out a way to create people power to respond to this increased attacks on poor communities and build allies for them, we're going to be seeing more of the same, just manifested in different ways.
Over in Europe, the country in the worst shape was, of course, Greece. And in their elections 2 weeks ago, the fascist party, which ran as a principal central aspect of their campaign, was an anti-immigrant, and they got 7% of the vote, and they're growing. And I think that's a preview of what might happen here when you've got people like Joe Arpaio and the sheriff in Arizona, an outright right-winger, gloating about the Show Me Your Papers law. I think that big reversal in Greece with that huge showing of the fascist party there is something that could very well happen here.
It is happening here. It's not like it could happen here. And it's happening everywhere. You saw the same increase for Le Pen in France in those elections. So it's a global phenomena. We also have to remember, though, because the worse the actor, the more the media and the more the discourse centers on them. There are sheriffs across the country who object to these policies. There are sheriffs across the country who have refused to implement these policies, who say this does not keep our communities safe. They have spoken out in legislatures. You could see the fight last year in Texas. A number of sheriffs from across the state came out against the copycat legislation that was Arizona-style in Texas. I also think we need to reach out to everyone who is ready to fight these things, and to give more attention to those officials who understand that this is not the way to make government run. Because if we consistently only focus on sheriffs who think that this is the only way to keep things safe, we are, in essence, reaffirming that message inadvertently. In addition to our failure to really talk about the fact that it's a human rights crisis that have brought people here, and then we strip them of their rights as a result of their being displaced from their home countries because of our economic policies, we also need to talk about the kind of unfettered discretion that ICE has over people's lives.
ICE is?
The Immigration Customs and Enforcement Agency. A lot of the decision focused on striking down the portions of the Arizona law that it did because it was reaffirming the authority the federal government had over immigration law. And a lot of, you know, people in liberal circles lauded that reaffirming of federal power. And we do think federal power as a general matter is important, but it's important in order to set a floor for basic rights protection. It is not intended to be unfettered. And right now, there isn't much of a conversation about the fact that the power that that agency has over 11 million, perhaps more, lives has no limits. They can literally create a life of ongoing terror for people because they know they can be deported at any time, find themselves separated from their families, and perhaps be sent back to a situation that's completely untenable. And I would just encourage that we have a bigger conversation about what should the limits be based on basic human rights questions that that agency has.
Well, Kathy Albisa from the National Economic Social Rights Initiative and from the Center for Constitutional Rights, you're a board member there.
Board chair, really, with
Michael and me. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. Archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Questa fossa dove stai, larga poche dita, è il più piccolo conto che hai pagato in vita.
È il più piccolo conto che hai pagato in vita.
A volume giusto, né largo né fondo, è la parte che ti tocca. Del latifondo,
è la parte che ti tocca del latifondo.
Non è una fossa grande, è giusta e precisa, è la terra che volevi veder divisa.
È la terra che volevi veder divisa.
È una fossa grande per un piccolo morto, ma hai più spazio attorno di quando eri al mondo. È una fossa grande per un morto da niente, ma qui più che nel mondo stai comodamente.
Ma qui più che nel mondo stai comodamente.
È una fossa grande, la tua carne è poca, ma la terra donata non si guarda in bocca.
Ma la terra donata non si guarda in bocca.
Today we get an update on the extent to which RFID technology is intruding in our daily lives. As many listeners may know, RFID stands for Radio Frequency Identification. In past shows, we've discussed how big companies are embedding or plan to embed the so-called spy chip into clothes, credit cards, shoes, and even into human flesh, all in the name of convenience, safety, and commerce. The breach of privacy from spy chip implantation is wide-reaching. Now, plans to develop implantable microchips for use in U.S. soldiers has taken a step forward. The U.S. military's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, has confirmed plans to create nanosensors to monitor the health of soldiers on battlefields. We're joined today by Dr. Catherine Albrecht, who, along with Liz McIntyre, authored Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Governments Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. We talk about DARPA and microchips, and we'll also get a preview about Catherine Albrecht's research into exposing how Google email is a threat to privacy between attorney and clients when they correspond.
Catherine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hey, it is wonderful to be on the program.
Now, we've covered the book Spy Chips a few times over the past years, but for listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you give us a brief summary of how you got interested in this field and what you found?
Well, what I discovered back in 2003 was that some of the world's largest corporations, 500 of them to be exact, had gotten together and come up with a plan to replace the barcode with tiny microchips hooked up to miniature antennas. Now, this initially was the idea, the brainchild of Procter & Gamble, to take the universal product code, or the barcode, and turn it into what they call the EPC, or the electronic barcode. So their concept is that we would create, or the manufacturers and retailers of the world, would create an Internet of Things, so that rather than have an Internet where all of these web pages are out there with information on them, that there would be an Internet where each individual object would have a unique ID number, and each individual object would then have its own database of information. So probably the best way to think of this is if you had a can of Coke in New York and I had a can of Coke here in New Hampshire, and we were to compare the barcodes on them, the UPC, or Universal Product Code, the numbers would be the same. In this new system, each can of Coke would have a unique individual number. So they would start off the same, you know, Coca-Cola Company, 12-ounce can, but then at the end they would have a little unique serial number, kind of like a social security number for things. And mine would be different from yours. In fact, all the ones in a six-pack, there would be six different unique ID serial numbers. They came up with a numbering system that they can encode into tiny microchips smaller than a speck of sand, that create enough unique number combinations to number every grain of sand on Earth with no duplicates. So they can certainly come up with unique ID numbers for all the cans of Coke and everything else for that matter. And if you had one of those cans of Coke, when you purchased it at the supermarket and you scanned it through the scanner, if you paid with a credit card, if you scanned a frequent shopper card, or in some other way identified yourself to the merchant, then they would record that unique ID number in a database and link up that item had been purchased by you. Now down the road, if somebody finds that can of Coke discarded by the side of the road, the litter police could pick it up, scan its unique number, look it up in the Internet of Things in that giant database, and say, oh, Catherine Albrecht bought that can of Coke at the Market Basket store on June 15th. We better send her a ticket in the mail for littering.
What if you gave the can to somebody else, Catherine, and they littered it?
Well, this is where it gets kind of interesting, because as I was researching this, there are plans, and we detail them in our book Spy Chips, to put doorway readers, hidden readers, into doorways in retail spaces and public spaces and elsewhere, so that as you walk through, they would scan everything that you were wearing and carrying. And I was once going off to give a speech on RFID, and I stopped and made kind of an inventory of all the things I was wearing and carrying in their vision of the future that would have an RFID tag. And it was, you know, my shoes and my underwear, my stockings, my skirt, my purse, my briefcase, my notebook, my chapstick, all that stuff. If I did have a can of Coke that had come from you, then that would be even more useful, because as I walk through the doorway, now they would know that, hey, Catherine Albrecht's been hanging out with Michael Smith, Michael Ratner, and Heidi Sojin.
That's fascinating.
So, It creates the potential to not only know all about me, but to know the people that I hang out with. And in fact, on that day, in my purse was a cheap, you know, 50-cent ballpoint Bic pen that I had actually accidentally taken from a reporter that I had met with earlier that week. And if they scan that, they'd say, oh, Catherine Albrecht's been doing interviews with the New York Times. How interesting. That's the kind of connections that you can make once individual items carry this kind of history on them.
Now, Catherine, I understand that there are hundreds or thousands of patents out for different applications for spy chips. I think one of the ones we discussed a few years ago was something like remotely shocking inmates who had been implanted. Is that far-fetched? Am I exaggerating the kinds
it's
of uses?
It's creepy. Well, you know, once you develop a technology that can transmit information using radio waves or receive radio waves to perform certain functions, then there are people out there who just have very bad imaginations. Some of those people are individuals who file patents that'll probably never go anywhere. Other times, those patents are filed by big companies like Philips Electronics and, you know, companies that we've all heard of that affect our everyday lives. And we actually found patents for things like that. I'm not sure how realistic it is that something like that would be implemented. But we did find other patents for things like medicine cabinets that would know when you take the lid off the aspirin bottle, or that would be able to detect, in fact, there's actual prototype products out there where they would embed the RFID microchip antenna directly into a pill that you would swallow and then monitor it as it made its way through your digestive tract to know if you were being compliant with your prescription regimen. So there are creepy patents out there. Procter & Gamble came up with an idea we detailed in our book to equip your refrigerator through the coming smart grid with RFID readers. And then they would know, what they describe is they would say, as if by magic, we would know when the consumer drank the last Pepsi in the refrigerator, and as if by magic, now ads on their cable television would begin to appear for Coke. So the idea would be that they'd monitor what you were eating, monitor what you would run out of, know that you were going to be going to the store and buying more of whatever it is, and then they would feed you advertisements, and then they'd even be able to verify whether the advertisements worked by checking what you put in your fridge the next time you stock your refrigerator. So there definitely are patents and plans, some of them creepier than others. I think this whole idea of RFID in people, you know, nobody wants to be spied on in their products or their fridge or their medicine cabinet, but when you start talking about putting this technology literally into human beings, I think that's when you start crossing a line into a whole other realm of creepiness. I actually worked closely with the Associated Press a couple of years back to release the information that I had found that the microchip, the implantable microchip known as the VeriChip, you can actually take this microchip antenna, encapsulate it in glass, and inject it into people. It's the identical technology they put into dogs and cats nowadays. And there is a company out there, keeps changing its name, VeriChip, Applied Digital Solutions, Digital Angel, it's gone by a bunch of different names. But they are trying to market this product for use in human beings. We did a six-month investigation that revealed that these implantable microchips were causing cancer in between 1 and 10% of the laboratory animals that they were being injected into. Now, these are laboratory mice and rats that get injected so that they have the unique ID number so that they can be tracked through their experimental processes that they're doing in these laboratories. And what the researchers began finding, they weren't even trying to study that. They were studying other things, but they began to discover that the animals that had been implanted with these microchips began to develop fast-growing malignant cancerous tumors around the microchips themselves. And it was leading to the death of the animals in 1 to 10% of cases. So right there, I think there's a huge concern. We've got communities all around the country that are mandating the use of microchips in dogs. There have been a number of dogs, cases of dogs that have died from the microchip causing a cancerous tumor in the dogs. We detail all of that if people want to go to our website at chipmenot.com. You can read the stories of animals, bats, dogs, rats, guinea pigs, all of these animals that are being injected with, they're not tracking microchips because they only have about a 6-inch read range, but they're ID microchips, and you can read the story about how they're causing cancer. A couple of years back in West Palm Beach, Florida, there was a place called the Alzheimer's Community Care Center that was working with the VeriChip Corporation to inject these microchips into Alzheimer's patients. And they had actually gotten, believe it or not, the caretakers of these Alzheimer's patients, their children, you know, their adult children, to sign a consent form for 200 of these Alzheimer's patients to be injected with a microchip. When we found out about it, it was just about the time that the Associated Press story was coming out, and we said, "This, you can't do this because these Alzheimer's patients are not in a position to give informed consent." You know, you can't consent for somebody else to be drugged or go through, you know, certain procedures that may be dangerous to them. So we went out there. I flew out to West Palm Beach. We had a protest, and we actually got that practice stopped. So as of today, to the absolute best of my knowledge and my extensive research into this, there is no population in the U.S. currently that is being microchipped, and I think that's a huge victory that it's not happening. But it doesn't mean it won't happen in the future.
Thanks for that explanation, Catherine. It really is creepy. Can I move over to the political scariness about all this? Because anonymity is really necessary for democracy.
You know, people always ask me why, because I've been doing privacy work since 1999, and my doctoral research at Harvard University was in the topic of privacy. And people say, you know, what's the big deal, really? Why do you care so much about privacy? And my answer is privacy is not an end. It's a means. Privacy in and of itself is really meaningless. What privacy is a way of you maintaining control over your own information. You know, people get really upset, and I want to move to internet privacy just a little bit. They'll say, oh, Facebook, it's terrible. You know, they're invading your privacy. And I say, no, they're really not. Facebook is not putting a camera in your bathroom and watching you without your permission. People are going onto Facebook and voluntarily revealing information about themselves through Facebook. Now, you have to take Facebook's privacy claims with a grain of salt. I tell everybody who uses Facebook, don't put anything on Facebook, private or otherwise, that you wouldn't put on a billboard in Times Square. But, you know, if you want to put your picture of you drunk at a party last night on a billboard in Times Square, then you know that, you know, Facebook is going to post that, and people are going to be able to see it, and you should be able to have that right. Where I get concerned is when we start talking about places where your privacy is invaded that you don't know it's happening and you don't have control over it. That's not Facebook. That's more getting into Google and Gmail and email programs and tracking cookies and online tracking. And once all of that stuff starts to get collected about you, then it begins to impede and interfere with democracy, with freedom, with all of the things that we value so much in this country. And I'll give you an example. Google is kind of my current project right now, because when you log on to Google, and I could say Yahoo or Bing too, because they're all doing this, you think that you're logging on to a search engine that's a helpful tool that's going to answer a question that you have. The reality is it does answer your questions, but Google does not view the Google.com search box as a helpful tool for you. They do not spend millions of dollars perfecting their search algorithm so they can give you stuff for free. They're not your mom, they're not your dad, they're not your best buddy. They're a company that's in business to make money. So what they do is they set this up as essentially bait to get you to log on to their system and tell them what you're thinking. You know, if you think about this from a government perspective, you know, Stalin and Pol Pot and Hitler and all these people going back would have given their eye teeth to have had a way to get the entire population 5, 10, 20 times a day to log into a centralized computer and upload what they were thinking about at that moment. But the reality is if they came at us with guns and tanks and laws and regulations forcing us to do that, we'd all say, heck no, we'd never do it. But when they give us, and by they here I'll go back to Google, when Google gives us a little window into which we can type what's on our minds, we voluntarily do it and we thank them for it. So another way to think of it, Google is a multi-billion dollar corporation. When was the last time a multi-billion dollar corporation gave you all of its products for free? And the answer is never, because those aren't products, they're bait, and you are the product. Let me transfer this over into email as well. Every Gmail that you send or receive is read and copied, and the keywords are placed into the profile of both the sender and the recipient of every email. Now, let me tell you why that's a disaster. My doctor, my primary care physician, I just overcame an 18-month battle with breast cancer. My doctor, who I love dearly, who's a total freedom-loving woman, she said, hey, listen, I need to get your latest blood test, and you just had a full workup on, you know, the cancer, and send that to me. And I said, well, I have it as a PDF. She said, well, send it as an attachment. And then she writes down her email address, and it's Gmail. Had I sent that to her, Google, according to its own privacy policy, would have stripped off my entire medical report from that PDF and placed it into their file that I don't even have access to, that I can't delete. They would have put it in their file, and then they would have known all of that about me. So this becomes not only a problem for privacy and control, because I certainly would not put my medical records up on a billboard in Times Square, but it also becomes a problem for dissidents and for people who are working for freedom in dangerous parts of the globe. You may have heard a couple of years ago there was a fairly high-profile case in which Google was hacked into by the Chinese. And the people whose accounts were hacked, these were Gmail accounts and Google searches and all the records that Google keeps, they were hacked because, we believe, the Chinese government wanted to identify dissidents so that they could round them up and lock them up. people whose identities that they were not able to get otherwise.
Yeah, it's so, absolutely creepy, Catherine.
I got to say, Michael, when people say, if you're not doing anything wrong, why should you care? All right, we've heard this 1,000 times. Well, let me tell you that if a woman is feels a lump in her breast and suspects she might have cancer, if a woman is going through a miscarriage and needs some counseling, if a man is wondering if his prescription drug usage might be tipping the scale over into addiction, if you are in the process of losing your home, or maybe you're looking for unemployment insurance, you're not doing anything wrong. But you certainly don't want that information out there in a giant database where it could fall into the wrong hands, or even where Google itself would have it. Why would I want anyone to know this personal information unless I chose to disclose it? So when people say you're not doing anything wrong, I say, no, we've all got a line of what's private and what's public, and it's not about right and wrong. That is a fake argument. That is an argument that these people will give you when they want to invade your privacy and they want you to suck it up and accept it. And we've got to get past, I'm not doing anything wrong. And we've got to get into, it's none of your blank business.
Now, Catherine, that brings up the issue, for example, of attorney-client privilege. If there are communications through Gmail, for example.
Huge issue. When you've got a situation where you are duty-bound and perhaps even legally bound to keep certain information private, if you are using a Gmail account, even if your client has a Gmail account and you don't, if you are transmitting sensitive information through there, I believe that you are in violation of not only your attorney-client privileges, but potentially even in violation of the law. And I believe that there will be in the future some major lawsuits over this, because Google clearly states in its privacy policy that that so-called free email program that they're giving you, which is really only worth about $5 a month, you're not getting a huge value from them. That, but in exchange for that, you are allowing them openly to copy and make records of everything that you send and transmit.
I want to take you back to spy chips for 1 second, because there's something about DARPA that I think you've spoken about, and the use of some kind of spy chips to monitor health or something of soldiers.
We know that DARPA...
DARPA, I'm sorry, what's...
Technology.
DARPA, Catherine, wait, what's DARPA?
Defense Area Research Projects Administration. I think I got that right. So DARPA is a branch of the U.S. military that does research into cutting-edge technologies for use in a military setting. So what DARPA does is you can figure out what the military is up to, the cutting-edge research. Most of it's classified, but you can tell because there are U.S. laws that require them to open up bids to the public so that multiple contractors can bid and it's all fair. So when they put out a request for proposals, you can read that and you can say, oh, they want to spend money on what? So we recently ran across a request for proposals through DARPA, a public request for contractors, to develop a system to inject nanotechnology microchips into the bloodstream of soldiers that would enable them to remotely monitor the physiological processes of the soldiers, so heart rate, exposure to anthrax, whatever it might be, and potentially even to physically track their location and do other things with them through swarms of nanobots, basically. So the way the request for proposals is written, they want first the winning company with the winning bid, within a period of about 2 years, they want them to be able to prove it in a Petri dish, in a Petri dish with cells. Then they want them to do it in a small mammal. Then they want them to do it in a large mammal. And within 4 years or so, they want them to have it safe enough that they could test it in human beings, and that would be in soldiers. So talk about your ultimate captive audience, as a soldier. We learned this back in, the 80s over the anthrax issue. If they tell you, roll up your sleeve, we're giving you a shot, you can't say no, or you'll be dishonorably discharged. It's a very frightening concept that they're working on this, and that at some future point, the people who are putting their lives on the line for our country would be guinea pigs for a potentially very dangerous and certainly privacy-invading technology.
Catherine, it sounds as though this is pretty far gone in terms of development and how it's pervading every aspect of our really digital lives. What do you advise people who are interested in this to do in terms of educating themselves? Can they protest? Can they bring back a modicum of privacy into their lives?
Well, this has been my question, I have to say, Heidi, for the 13 years that I've been doing this work, because initially my goal was just to inform, and I just thought if I could just get the word out, this is why we wrote Spy Chips and why I do a daily radio program and all the things that I do. I thought if people just knew, then they would solve it. And, of course, the reality, people are busy. They've got their own concerns in today's economy. They're trying to keep a roof over their heads, and it's very difficult to fight back against this unless you have an army of people who can do it. So then I shifted gears a couple of years ago, and I said, well, if we can't get this to stop, then let's provide alternatives. And let me go to the Google issue, for example. I helped to develop an alternative portal to Google that is completely private. So you can do your Google searches. You'll get Google results without the tracking and without your information going into the database. So what I did as a radio host, I actually had on my show a guest from a company called IxQuick, I-X-Q-U-I-C-K, in Europe, a little company, that was doing private searching. And I work with them as a consultant to kind of grow their, you know, exposure to what they were doing as a private search engine. And then I said, hey, guys, nobody can spell IxQuick. You know, it's got an X and a Q and a K, and it's impossible. And plus, people really want Google results. So we worked together to develop an alternative portal, which is StartPage, StartPage.com, StartPage.com. Which we called it that because we wanted to be your start page, your home page, instead of Google or instead of Bing or whatever you're using. So when you go to start page, you'll see a window just like Google where you can type in your search of whatever you're going to search for. And what start page does is we take your search and then we strip out your IP address. We only record zeros, so we don't know where you are or who you are. We take the search term, and instead of serving it from your location in New York or me in New Hampshire, we serve it from StartPage's California servers to Google. Google then gets the search query, returns the results. We strip out all the Google tracking cookies, make it completely clean of just results, no Google, and then we serve that cleanly back to you through StartPage.com. So it's a way, and by the way, if you go to startpage.com, you'll see right on there, there's a way to add it to your browser so it becomes available in that upper right-hand corner. The browsers nowadays all come preloaded with Google and with Bing. And you pull down that menu in the corner. You can actually, if you follow the instructions on the homepage at startpage.com where it says add to Firefox or add to IE or whatever, you can actually make StartPage one of your pull-down options, so that when you put your search in there, it goes privately through StartPage. Now, that's been such an enormous hit. We actually believe that we're the biggest privacy service on the Internet today because we're serving over 2 million searches a day through StartPage and IxQuick. And we're in the process of developing a private email alternative to Gmail that will be coming out in early 2013 that will be totally encrypted, totally private, and nobody will read your email either.
This is always so enlightening, frightening, and positively exciting about the work that you are doing, and StartPage is something that I think many of us are going to be going to immediately.
So glad to hear it. Always a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you guys so much for all you do as well.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web.